Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now into the second year of the Trump administration, and the last year has been filled with ups and downs, important victories, successful holding campaigns, and painful defeats. We've learned a lot, but there's always more to learn and more to be done. In this now weekly series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I am Richard R.J. Eskow, writer and host of The Zero Hour, a radio program syndicated and TV show on Free Speech TV.
All right. So we are talking because you are the co-author of a new platform for, well, I'll let you tell us what it's for.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of the authors. There are a number of them, and others have really done more than I on it, but I am a signer and one of the authors of a pledge for good jobs, sustainable prosperity, and economic justice. And basically, the guiding principle behind it is what I've been writing about since the election, which is that resistance is not enough.
Right.
That I think I use the phrase beyond resistance, mm-hmm. and I think others have done that as well. The notion that we simply stand in abhorrence and rejection of the Trump agenda is mm-hmm. not enough. The notion that we reject the Republican and conservative agenda, which I consider personally Trump not to be a deviation from,
right.
but the final fruition of,
yeah.
is better. But then it leaves open the question, what does a resistance, whether it's electoral in nature, whether it's activist in nature, what is the affirmative agenda that a resistance stands for? What is it that people would do? What should Democrats run on as a party? What should left independents run on if they're electable? What should movements be demanding in terms of an economic platform that concretely makes people's lives better so that they become politically engaged in every dimension of that, from going out and voting to demanding a better life, rather than the kind of discouragement that comes with everything is horrible.
Yeah.
That's as best as I can explain it, the gist of where this comes from. What can we get a lot of people to agree is a real program for economic transformation, recognizing that both political parties, to a greater or lesser extent, have let us down in certain areas economically. What do people need? What do people want? What can we rally behind as a movement? That's the ambition here.
I, and probably most people who will be consuming this, agree that resistance is not enough. It's an interesting time to be talking about platforms because the Democratic Party doesn't really run on its platform. This is not really a thing that we're used to in this country in the same way. Our politics tend to revolve around personalities. And so
right.
I'd love if you could talk a little bit about sort of the usefulness of having a policy platform that comes before being attached to any particular personality or set of personalities.
Well, I've felt it is the question. It's a great question. And the Corbyn Manifesto is something that's got a lot of people excited and energized. I think there are a lot of reasons to have. Well, first of all, our personality-driven politics, I think, has driven a lot of people over the edge a little bit. I think we have a tendency to view our elected officials as external manifestations of our own identity, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I think that has, and I don't mean in the political sense of identity politics, but just ego almost. And I think that gets us distracted. That, you know, people say I like Hillary, I like Bernie, I don't like Hillary, I don't like, you know, whomever. It's really beside the point that if you're really talking about building a movement, of which electoral politics is a part, but only a part, then you have to have a set of beliefs that a large number of people can agree upon. And one of the things that's been very interesting to me in trying to help build consensus around this particular 11-point platform is I worked for Bernie. I was Bernie's writer in during his presidential campaign. I clearly come out of the left-wing democratic socialist camp. I was not even a member of the Democratic Party for a number of years, although I've rejoined since I moved to Maryland. But I come from that particular tradition, but what's been striking to me in this conversation has been, even though this document explicitly declares that both parties have failed to meet the public's needs when it comes to an economic agenda, people from across the Democratic Party base, including people outside the party, but people from what would be called the Hillary side of the party, including some fairly prominent Hillary supporters, and people who are solidly Bernie people, have all kind of come together around this platform. And that to me is striking and tells me a couple of things. One is that there's some room for optimism. Two, that all the polling that shows that Democrats and left-leaning independents want this is really kind of sort of verified by that. And three, it tells me, getting back to your question, that people have gotten distracted a lot by their affinity on a personal level or their dislike on a personal level for individual politicians and have failed to see that there are some underlying principles that they can agree on.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting, useful point to make, I think. So that gets us to, what are these principles? What is in the platform? Give us a quick rundown.
Well, one of them is to invest substantially in infrastructure and job creation. Another is to retool the U.S. energy system so that we have a sustainable and truly green economy and grid, reversing the Trump tax cuts more reasonable taxation, that is to say higher taxation on corporations and the wealthy, reducing inequality by attacking economic racism, targeting the communities that have been especially harmed by racism, xenophobia, targeting restorative economic justice for women in the workforce and in the home, free public college, that is to say tuition free for everyone at public colleges and universities, Medicare for all, strengthening Social Security, and substantial additional banking reform to close down that casino that's open 24/7 there on Wall Street, and substantial political reform so that we no longer live in a functional oligarchy.
So that's quite a list. I also noticed in the draft that you sent me that there's a call for a student debt jubilee as well. So dealing with existing student debt as well as the future production of student debt.
Yeah, and that's a personal issue of mine that I've been on for quite a while, and there was a report released last week by the Levy Institute at Bard College showing that a complete cancellation of student debt in this country, all $1.4 trillion at the time of the analysis, I think it's 1.5 now or close to it, that canceling all that student debt, all of it, 92% or thereabouts of which is held by the federal government, would actually have a significant boosting effect on the economy, would grow the GDP, and would create more than 1 million new jobs. So there's no reason not to do it other than the perceived questions of moral hazard and all that sort of thing, which is a whole other conversation we could have. Mm-hmm. But there are compelling reasons economically to do it, and there are compelling moral reasons to do it, since these 44 million Americans who struggle with it today really are the victims of a failed social experiment, that we could transfer the cost of their higher education onto them as individuals, and somehow it would all work out. Yeah. It was kind of a neoliberal idea, and it didn't work out. So tuition-free public higher education plus cancellation of current student debt, to me, is a very compelling agenda.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about the process and the people that came together to write this, and how folks decided on coming up with a platform.
Well, at the initial impetus, Roger Hickey, who was co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, I think he's really been a key driver on all of this, and he convened a small group. Some number of months ago, including Robert Borisage, who was the other co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Larry Cohen, who was the head of the Communication Workers of America, and then a key Bernie advisor, which is how I got to know Larry, and is now a board chair of Our Revolution. So it was basically, that was the gang of four that started drafting this thing. And then as it moved along, we started getting feedback from people that might be potential signers, to see, where the points of disagreement were. And from my perspective, anyway, that was a pleasant surprise in the number of people, first of all, who were willing to agree that both parties could have done more, which is something I thought would be more contentious than it proved. Not everybody was okay with that, but most people were, and that was a pleasant surprise for me. And the fact that these really ambitious ideas for the future were things that so many people could endorse and embrace. And I'm talking about everyone from Robert Reich to Bill McKibben to Naomi Klein, all of whom you might expect. Gloria Steinem, trying to think who, Jane Fonda, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, a number of people, James Galbraith, economist, Annie Leonard of Greenpeace, and so on. A number of different people, really a diversity of viewpoints reflected, and Heather Gauthney, sociologist, Angela Glover-Blackwell. I mean, I could go on and on, but the point, Dan Cantor from the Working Families Party, but I guess my main point is we got a lot of people who are willing to say, we will not only sign this thing, but we'll make, it's a pledge, it's a personal commitment to say, I will be a spokesperson and advocate for this agenda.
Yeah.
And so I was, for me, that was the pleasant surprise.
And so, of course, it's election year, with all the fun and excitement that brings. But it's an election year where, Democrats are counting on some of this quote unquote resistance energy to carry them through. And so what role do you envision this platform and the people who signed it playing this year?
Well, I mean, when we talk about the Democratic Party, I always feel we have to distinguish the rank and file members of the party from the people of influence who have influence and power in the party leadership, because I think they're two very distinct populations. I've written a lot over the past year about the opinions of Democratic Party registered Democrats. They want the party to move left. They want new leaders. They want polling shows that they are strongly progressive economically. Then, of course, we have, it's no secret to you or most of the people listening to this, that there is an entrenched resistance to that form of resistance within the Democratic Party. So I think there will be a lot of people who are hoping that the party can make it to victory in November without committing to any specific transformative economic agenda. That is enough to say, oh, that Trump, we hate him, he's awful, don't you hate him too, come on out and vote. And I mean, there are only two ways that can play out in my book. Number one is I think we tried it in 2016, it didn't work out that well. And we're already seeing now the latest polling showing that the generic Democrat is losing ground to the generic Republican, because there is that vacuum, I believe, where the Democratic Party doesn't talk enough about how it will affect people's lives. And when it does talk about it, it's in sort of mumbo jumbo, lack of specificity. So I think there is a leadership contingent that would like to keep things vague and just run on resistance, meaning, you know, let's all talk about how much we hate that guy, and maybe we can get some upset Republicans to vote with us, which didn't happen in 2016 to speak of, and all will be well and good. Now, either they will eat their way to victory, which I don't think will happen, or they will, you know, if they do, the best case scenario is they eke their way to a victory. They still don't have the Senate or the presidency, and they have no mandate to propose anything new. And so they have no case to make when it comes time to try to win back the Senate and the presidency. So either they lose in November, or they're in a long-term state of continued decline. I don't see it working out any other way. But if the rank and file can pressure the party, can demand an agenda like this from the party, things will be different, because more leaders will commit to it, more people will prevail in the primaries who stand for this kind of an agenda. The party will really be something people can identify with, and I think that it greatly improves its chances in November and its chances going forward.
So what can people who are listening to or reading this do to support it?
Well, number one, they can go read it the website is campaignforamericasfuture.org, and when they read it and realize how strongly they agree, then they can sign it and add their name, and then they'll be part of, you know, all the follow-up communication, and there'll be further actions down the road.
Excellent. And how can people keep up with you and your work?
Well, that's a moving target, but patreon.com/thezerohour is one way, and ourfuture.org is another, and otherwise I'll be there. What's the Grapes of Wrath speech? Wherever cops are beating up a guy, wherever. But those are the main places to look for me. We hope you'll join us, and we really think we can get something started here.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.